Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnall-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Sandra Johnson. Each week, we visit with an author from our region, get an introduction to their work, sometimes a glimpse into their lives. We find out what prompts them to write and give them an opportunity to read from their work. This week, we're very pleased to have Sandra Johnson with us. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you.
Sandra and her husband, Paul, lived in Bayview Village and worked in Toronto. Sandra was an accountant and Paul running his own business. After the death of his father and uncles, all in their 60s, Paul decided he should retire at 40, since the chances of surviving to a ripe old age didn't look too good. Two of Paul's business associates had taken up sailing and loved it. One lent the Johnsons 2 years of Cruising World magazine, and Sandra was persuaded that life at sea looked like a viable option. But they'd never sailed before, though Paul had been in the Navy for 7 years. However, they sold their house and belongings and bought a boat. Wow, Sandra, wasn't that a huge leap in the dark? It must have taken a great deal of courage. How did you decide on what kind of boat to buy? And what features persuaded you to purchase quarterdeck?
Well, there are formulas for the tipping or capsize rate of boat configurations. Also, for the length of the ocean waves, there are more desirable boat lengths. We knew we needed a heavy boat, and quarterdeck is 20 tons, 40,000 pounds. She always felt steady and sturdy, and we never doubted her strength. The boat manufacturer had a very good reputation. We wanted an aft cabin, a center cockpit, and multiple sails for a variety of sailing conditions, and the CSY, Caribbean Sailing Yacht, had all of this.
So it was a standard boat. You didn't have it customized for you,
no?
No. And did you always intend to sail around the world, or did it just happen?
We never cared that we finished the circumnavigation. We loved the lifestyle, and wherever we ended up would have been fine with us. We sailed 79,000 miles, almost three times around the world, and visited 64 countries.
Which country did you most enjoy visiting?
We loved Australia and stayed three cruising seasons, leaving during the six-month cyclone season for New Caledonia and Vanuatu, and then back to Australia after the cyclone season ended. Also, we spent five Christmases, or 4 years, in Southeast Asia, taking three trips to Chagos in the middle of the Indian Ocean during the northeast monsoon season, and then back to Southeast Asia.
Wow. So was it very costly to live this way? Did you ever become ill? And how about healthcare? How did you manage that?
We spent on average about $14,000 a year, and most of that goes on the boat. We ate a lot of fish and rice, rarely stayed in marinas, and never ate at expensive restaurants. We were never ill. It was a healthy lifestyle, and we were never around sick people. Health care in the third world countries is socialized and mostly free. I carried sutures, Novocaine, and many medicines, and any medical personnel in the cruising fleet or on land could always use this and help us or others. Doctors also would prescribe for us living offshore in case of emergencies. Our American, Canadian, and European medical personnel do their internship often in the third world countries, so the health care is usually very good. Any cruiser needing a bone set or emergency surgeries that we knew found that when they did get home and were examined, their doctors said they could not have done better. India has even started to advertise to come and have cardiac operations there and recover on their beaches.
Mm-hmm. So, but you were healthy all the way.
Oh, yes.
So now you've written two books about your adventures. Did you write the first while you were still traveling?
No. I always kept a log of our adventures, and I also wrote them in letters to our friends and family. When we finished cruising, people encouraged me to write a book, but without my photographs, I couldn't imagine having a book without my colorful photographs, and it was far too expensive to publish with any colored pages. The first book I wrote in 2012 when a cruising friend journalist introduced me to e-books. Now I could write with my photos complementing my dialogue, and they are only JPEGs.
Yes. Could you read us an excerpt from your first book, The World is My Oyster?
Okay. Quarterdeck, quarterdeck, this is Rafiki we heard over the radio. It was our friends who had helped us step our mast at Castleton on the Hudson 3 months prior. It was Christmas Eve, and they knew of a spot close to them in the Liverboard area of Fort Lauderdale. What fun to catch up and have friends to spend Christmas with. No one wanted to pay overtime on holidays to check into the Bahamas, so we spent between Christmas and New Year's in Fort Lauderdale. We explored the town on our bicycles. There were lots of cruisers around us. We watched the weather and gathered guidebooks and charts and boating equipment from the Chandleries. We said goodbye and backed out of our slip, even though I wasn't quite ready. We motored out into the intercoastal waterway. I was below taking screens out of the forward hatch over our V-berth when Paul shouted that a powerboat was approaching with a huge wake. I couldn't work fast enough to flip the levers holding the teak frame screen, drop that, and release the hatch support to close the hatch. A funnel of filthy brown water poured down on me as our bows dipped into the trough of powerboat wake. I was soaked. Our pillows and sheets were soaked. The powerboat was obviously over the speed limit, breaking the no-wake rule. Paul asked if I wanted to return to do a laundry. I refused, saying to continue on. We had exciting adventures ahead. Boats gather for the crossing of the Gulf Stream at No Name Harbor, Key Biscayne. We were approaching from the ocean and south of Key Biscayne. The water was shallow, and we had to keep to the channel. Our boat engine was overheating. Paul went below and had the stairs out to get at the engine and find the problem. I had the wheel under sail, watching our depth, our sails, and the channel. Ahead and to the side of us, I could see a house. In the middle of the water was a house. This wasn't on our chart. I wasn't sure I should believe my eyes. Paul was too busy to check this out. I figured it had to be very shallow there. We later learned that people trying to avoid property tax built out on the water. We managed to keep our sails set through the channel and anchored under sail, a first for us. There were so many boats in No Name Harbor we would not have fit in. We slept well enough outside the harbor after our excitement. We took the dinghy in the next day to compare weather notes with the other cruisers. Agreement was made as to the departure time and course. It seemed such a big step crossing the Gulf Stream to the Bahamas, but it was only an overnight passage. The radio chattered all night long with position reports. I tired quickly with a bad head cold and slept towards dawn. We entered between Cat and Gun Key. After months of dirty brown water in the intercoastal waterway, it was frightening to see bottom. The water of the Bahamas is gin clear. We didn't believe our depth sounder that we had 30 feet under our keel. We could see coral and fish and conch. We anchored on the east side and got some sleep. Our weather window was very short, and the next norther was upon us. We merely followed the winds around and anchored on the west or north side of the island, then back on the east side. Paul went scuba diving with the other fellows to see the beautiful coral and fish. A neighboring boat beckoned Paul over. He told Paul if he just snorkeled, there was plenty of lobster to snare, but it was illegal to snare them with scuba gear. We soon had lobsters for dinner, big ones too. The radio was noisy with methods of cleaning and cooking. The next day I explored the perfect sandy cove, Horseshoe Cove, on the north of Gun Key. I found a helmet shell, empty, pink, and shiny. This was just like the magazines. Paradise. With the norther gone, we set out across the banks, more than 100 miles across a pure white sand bottom, dolphins dancing in our bow wake and only 10 foot deep. We anchored on the banks that night, the most peaceful starry night. We were living our dream.
That was lovely, Sandra.
Thank you.
Lovely. You obviously weren't alone when you were sailing on these journeys. How did you join a cruising fleet?
Boats travel at the same time of year because of the season of the winds.
Uh-huh.
And so you usually have boats all around you, and you meet other boats coming down the intercoastal waterway.
Right.
And so then they all cross together at the same time because the winds are favorable for that crossing. So there's always a lot of boats around you.
I see. So it's a sort of informal company.
It's very social, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I hadn't realized that people, you know, hooked up with each other during these cruises, as it were.
Yeah, and like going down the East Coast, they say, well, I have an uncle in Washington, so I'll catch up later. And, you know, so people have their own agenda in that respect. But you do keep running into the same people, and even when you're doing a circumnavigation.
Fascinating. Thank you, Sandra. We'll take a short break.